Shoot the defense, the best podcast in the world. We're out here.
I keep saying Henry's a forward.
Richie, who's the best striker you've played against?
Henry.
And the fact that we are now taking our country and put our country on the map of world soccer, being the first African nation, the third world nation in the whole world to win an Olympic gold medal in soccer, you know, it was unbelievable.
If you're going to take the time to go and get a pig head and break my locker open and wrap my clothes in it, and send in a different message to me.
I've had to protect my family from going out into the street because you'll have random people that just coming up and abusing them racially. Even some old school managers who are British, they still have the same racial undertones like the man in the street who they're trying to condemn.
Hello, welcome to another edition of Shoot the Defence. This is my top five matches. I'm your host, Stel, and I'm joined by my co-host, not Rodriguez this time. He's a little bit under the weather. We're not going to send him any cards to wish him well because he'll be back soon, he's Rod. But his replacement, well, he's back from España, aren't you, amigo? Kojo, how you doing?
Amigo. Back home in London, England.
¿Qué tal?
Bien tú.
Oh, yeah, he goes. He's learning the lingo. He's only been there 5 minutes and he's come back and he's speaking it like a true Spaniard. Look at this. But you've been well,
though. Try my best.
Good. Well, listen, I'm glad that you're back, but not because you're back, if that makes sense. You know, because you lost that little position you had in Spain, coaching. But I'm sure you'll be back soon, man.
Yeah, obviously coronavirus messed everything up because the plan after Spain was to go to Mexico. But, you know, I'm back home. I'll earn some money over here and then I'll continue with that going forward. So it's not the end at all. Coronavirus has held things back a little bit, you know. So we move forward. But I'm good. Everything good.
It's just put a pin in it, mate. Don't worry, you'll be fine.
Exactly.
Senoritas are waiting for you. Don't worry about it. Anyway. Right, we have a very special guest on this episode. He's making his debut on Shoot the Defence. I hope it's the first of many to come. It's former Manchester United, Middlesbrough, West Brom, or blimey, Fulham midfielder Jonathan Greening. Jonathan, welcome to the show, mate. How you doing?
Hello, how are you doing? Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's an absolute pleasure, man. Thanks for coming on. I know you've been really busy. How are you coping?
Not really that busy, mate. I've been locked down for 7 weeks.
Well, you know, last time we spoke, you were about to go to America, and you were obviously worried about queuing up for 3 hours.
Yeah. Well, that one got cancelled. We were supposed to go to LA coaching in San Francisco for 10 days, but with the coronavirus happening, it got cancelled about 48 hours before it was due to go. So it's been pretty quiet lately.
Oh, bloody hell. So, but I take it you're going to go back eventually, no?
Yeah. We usually go out to the States probably 8-9 times a year, just recruiting players to come over to York to do, you know, this football, you know, uni academy we've got going in York, where I work is, which is Eye to Eye. So we're usually out there, you know, at least probably 7 or 8 times a year.
So how many states do you cover? Is it a couple or?
Oh, mate, honestly, sometimes it rolls into one, mate. Sometimes we hit the East Coast, we do New York, New Jersey, Philadelphia, then we'll fly to the West Coast and do LA, San Fran, Napa Valley, and then we usually fly back home, and then sometimes we go to Texas, do Texas. Where else have we been? We've been to Alabama, Canada, we've been to India, we've been everywhere, wow, mate. Because what we do, we recruit international students to come over to do a degree in York, and obviously to do the football alongside it. So we've been doing it 4 years. It's really enjoyable because obviously you get to see, you know, everywhere, you know, around the world, and see young players who want to try and make it as footballers.
Absolutely. And with regards to the United States, when you go from state to state, do you notice a difference in attitudes towards the game? Are people more passionate on one part of the country than others?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, California is probably the biggest state where they probably like the football. Well, they call it soccer, don't they? So they like the soccer the most. I think there's a lot of, you know, Mexican kids and South American kids who obviously moved to California, you know, with their parents, and they're obviously, you know, absolutely love soccer. Most of the American kids, you know, some of the states we go to, most of the American kids obviously love the American football and basketball and, you know, baseball and stuff like that. But, you know, when you go to California, most of like the South American kids and the lads from, you know, Puerto Rico and places like that who've moved to, you know, California. They absolutely love soccer, probably from, you know, the mums and dads and that.
Right. Okay, that's understandable. That's understandable. Well, hope it continues, mate, because obviously, as Kojo said, this has put a pin in a few people's projects and whatnot, but you'll be back in no time, I guess.
Yeah, we'll be back, mate. I'm sure once the flights resume and things start getting back to normal, we'll be back out there doing our business as usual.
And before I forget, I hope Matty is doing a scouting mission for you guys in Cyprus.
Matty, I don't call him Matty, I call him Dabs, mate, or Thunderbuddy. You know, I've known Dabs, you know, since my Forest days, and he's top man. You know, he's absolutely killing it in Cyprus, isn't he? You know, every time I look at his Insta page, he's bragging about how many goals he's scored. So, but he's the old original fox in the box, isn't he? You know, he knows where the back of the net is, and he's a top lad, his Dabs.
He's a legend.
He's top man. To be fair, we signed for Forest the same time, and we sort of like hit it off straight away. We started rooming together and stuff like that, and staying overnights before games, and you know, we got on from day one. Really, he's a top lad. He's easy to get along with.
Well, as Kojo knows, he plays for the team that I support in Cyprus, and
okay.
So Omonia is a very big, a big club in my eyes. You know, it's a little club, but in my eyes, it's a big club. Do you get what I'm saying? So when I found out that Henning Berg became head coach in the summer, I was like, this is crazy. This should not be happening for a team in Cyprus. You know, so, you know, Matt Derbyshire.
Is Henning Berg still the manager there, or is he left now?
I don't know. As far as I'm aware, he's still there.
Right. Because obviously, I played with Henning Berg. He's a top lad, is Henning.
Oh, okay. Well, I didn't know anything about him leaving, so I presume he's still there.
Good.
Is there something you know that I don't?
No. I mean, I don't really, you know, take much notice of the results. I only look at when Dabs have scored, but I didn't even know Henning Berg was the manager, to be honest. Yeah. But I only say it because, you know, I played with Henning, and he was a top lad.
Yeah. Well, he joined in the summer. I know people are listening and thinking, what the hell's going on here? But he joined in the summer, and they're very close to doing the double out there, and obviously coronavirus hit. But yeah. In Cyprus, clubs are very well known for sacking managers. I mean, the best team out there, Apoel, they've gone through four managers this season. So,
wow.
Yeah, so there you go. Right, so before our listeners get completely bored of Cypriot football, because I've mentioned them on the last pod, I'm not going to go into it again. Let's talk about your top five matches, mate. And we'll begin on with your debut for York City. I believe it was a 1-1 draw against Crewe. Was that the final day of the season?
Yeah. So it was. So obviously, you know, it's in my probably top five games because, you know, as a young kid, I just wanted to be a professional footballer. It's my biggest aim, you know, in life. From probably about 6 or 7 years old, I wanted to be a footballer. And obviously, you know, going through the schoolboys at York City and then doing the old famous YTS scheme. And, you know, I was a second year YT, and literally 3 days before that game against Crewe, I got called up to the first team squad to train with them. And I ended up, you know, the manager pulling me in the day before and saying I was going to be on the bench, and I was absolutely, obviously, over the moon. You know, I just turned 18. I'd just been offered a year pro, first year pro, on a massive £135 a week.
Wow.
Can you believe it? Get a steady pay rise from 38 quid a week to 135. And it was basically out of the blue because, you know, obviously it was last game, and I was thinking, obviously, I'd signed my year pro, I was going to go back training in the pre-season and start as a pro. But, you know, I ended up sneaking on the bench, and literally someone got injured literally 5-10 minutes into the game, and the managers turned around to me and said, listen, get stripped, you're going on. And I was like, you're joking. I had a massive panic up straight away, do you know what I mean? Because I didn't expect to go on, because it was like three or four other pros, you know, obviously, you know, more experience than me. And I think it was 0-0 at the time, and literally I just stripped off, and, you know, on I went, and I ended up playing right wing and playing really well, and ended up getting man of the match. So, you know, it was just an amazing feeling, just because, you know, you strive, you know, from a young kid to be a professional footballer. So to make your debut, you know, against, you know, a good team at the time. I think Robbie Savage was actually playing for Crewe at the time.
Oh, wow.
Was a massive thing for me. Obviously, my mum and dad were there. My brothers and sisters were there as well. It's up there in my top five, just because how much it meant to me, you know, making my debut as a professional footballer. And it's one of the one of the biggest things I remember from the day was just how excited I was, and how nervous I was, and after the game, just I was so glad it was all over with, really, because I was proper petrified before the game.
I can imagine, mate. And when you mentioned the YTS scheme, as far as I'm aware, that was kind of like the back end of when that was prevalent in youth football, I guess, because as far as I'm aware, it was about cleaning boots. It was about cleaning the stadium. You were assigned a player to look after, so to speak. And obviously, York City being a fairly small club in comparison to the bigger clubs, I guess your responsibilities were even greater, no?
Yeah, it was mental, mate. Honestly, it was probably two of my best years of my life, to be honest with you, because you go into it, leaving school, you just finish your GCSEs, then you start, in the July as a YTS, as a 16-year-old. And you basically, you get all your jobs you're doing. So you're in there at 8 o'clock in the morning, cleaning the change room, setting the kit out, making cups of teas and coffees for the older pros, and cleaning the boots. Like you say, I think I got two pros boots to clean, doing all the kit, cleaning the minibus, all that kind of stuff before you even training begins. And then obviously you train for a few hours, and then you come back and then you're doing all the jobs again, cleaning, washing the kit, drying the kit, mopping and brushing the corridors. It was just mental, because it's a learning curve, because you need to respect the older pros, because they come down with you like a ton of bricks. I remember once not cleaning one of the lads' boots, and he went absolutely crazy, and he probably wouldn't happen now, but about three or four of the pros got me in the boot room, turned lights off, and got the, remember the metal things you used to clean the mud off?
Oh, yes.
Just going down my backs and my legs with this metal scrape until my hamstrings were bleeding. You couldn't get away with it nowadays.
Well, I'm not going to ask who did it, but was it Mark Tinkler?
No, it weren't Tinkler. Tinks was a top lad, to be fair. No, I mean, it was just a bit of banter, do you know what I mean? But, after that, I never ever forgot not to do the boots again, you know what I mean? But it's just the way it is, I think. Nowadays, some of the younger pros and younger YTs, they're not even called YTs now, are they? I think, they probably don't have to do any of these
Academy
jobs anymore.
Academy graduates,
that's what it's called now, mate. It's the best 2 years of my life, to be honest. I learned so much in them 2 years.
Well, I remember you had the likes of David Rush there, who was at Sunderland for a good few years, and then Graham Murty was breaking through, who ended up at Reading, I think.
That's right.
And I think Tony Barris was there as well. He was a tough player, wasn't he?
Yeah, well, Tony was a tough player. We had some really, tough players in our team. Steve Tuttle, Rushy, like you said, was there. Tinks came towards the end of mine from Leeds, who was a top lad. We had the captain at the time, Nigel Pepper, was an absolute nut job as well. It was a team full of characters, and if you couldn't take any banter, and if you couldn't take any jokes played on you, then you'd struggle badly. But I remember it really fondly, especially some of the stories. I remember Nigel Pepper once, saying to me about an hour before kickoff, can you go and put a bet on for me down Bookies round corner? And I was like, yeah, if you want. I think I was like 16 years old. And I remember him, his bet winning, and he won about 500 quid. So I've gone to take the money back to Pep before the game, and he's going out of the tunnel with the team. Obviously, he was captain, you see. And as I go by him, I said, "You've won." He went, "How much?" And I said, "Something like 500 quid, I think it was." I had it all in like £20 notes, a massive wad. And he just put it down his socks next to his shin pads, put his socks back up, and went out and played the game. And I was like, absolute, I couldn't believe it, but he was playing with like 500 quid down his sock. It was unbelievable.
Incredible, absolutely incredible. I mean, he was a focal point in York's win against United, wasn't he?
Yeah, massive. Yeah, he was. He was a top player, centre midfield. Real hard man, never jerked a tackle or anything like that. Loved a 50-50. And like you say, he was probably one of the best players at York City in that period. And one a lot of the young lads looked up to.
Absolutely, mate. So, you get your move to Manchester United. I'm sure you've been asked this question a million and one times, and Kojo is also a United fan like myself. So, how did that move come about?
Well, it's a strange one, really, because I think it was probably about 6 months before I actually made my debut for York, and I'd played a Resi game on a Tuesday night, and we played Sheffield United in a Resi game, and we won 4-0, and I scored all four goals.
Oh, yeah.
And the next day, one of the coaches just sort of like said to me, "Oh, by the way, there was a Man United scout in the stadium last night, and you know, he was really impressed with you." And I was like, "All right," sort of like, you know, sort of like pushed it aside really. And then literally, probably 6 or 7 months later, we played a first team game for York against Fulham at home at Beauvham Crescent. And I started the game, and to be fair to you, I was absolutely atrocious. Like, I played so bad, I was horrendous. You know when you play bad, don't you? So after the game, I'm walking out the grounds, and the manager at the time, Alan Little, sees me walking by his office and says, "Jono, I want a word." And I was like, "Oh shit, you know what? You know what? About, you know, he's going to go mental because I played so bad." So I've sat down. And he says, "How do you fancy going to Man United on Monday for 4 days training?" And I was like, "Is this a joke? Are you going to bollock me because I played so bad?" And he'd be like, "No, I'm being serious. You know, we've had Alex Ferguson on the phone. He wants you to go training on Monday for 4 days." And I was like, "Oh, right. So it's not a joke." Anyway, it wasn't a joke. And I ended up going to training on the Monday down at the cliff, thinking I was training with the youth team. And I literally was training with all the players, you know, Bex, Giggsy, Keno, all of them. And I trained with them Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And after the training session on Thursday, Alex Ferguson got me into his office and said, "Listen, you know, we've watched you for 4 days. We really like you. You know, we invite a few people in on trial to see how they react with the players. And you've done absolutely brilliant. And, you know, thanks for coming," kind of thing. So I went away back to York, you know, after the training session on Thursday to play in the game on the Saturday, thinking, you know, at least I've done all right. You know, Alex Ferguson has said I've done all right. And then in the back of my mind, I was thinking, he probably says that to all the young lads, you know what I mean? He's just trying to be nice to me. That was probably crap. And then literally a couple of weeks later, got a call from York saying they'd agreed a fee and would I like to go and talk to United and, talk about a contract.
I was listening to a podcast the other day with Stephen Caldwell, and he hosted it with Darren Fletcher. And there was one part where Darren Fletcher said that he was umming and ahhing about signing the contract at United. He was about 15 years old. And Sir Alex has called him at home and he's given him the biggest bollocking of his life. And Fletcher's mum gets the phone and she goes, "Don't ever call this phone ever again." And just hung up on him. She goes, "I don't care who you are."
Yeah, well, it was a strange one for me because I didn't have an agent at the time. Right. I was only just 19, I think. I didn't have an agent or anything like that. I didn't really, you know, anything about it, that kind of situation. I didn't think I was going to go from York City to Manchester United, you know, in such a short space of time. So I literally went to the cliff with my mum and dad. And my dad didn't really like driving on motorways. He had a little crappy banger car. Didn't really like risking it on motorways. So we got like a cab from Scarborough to Manchester. Somebody who my dad knows from work, who did taxi driving on the side. And we ended up going to the cliff to meet Sir Alex. Well, he worked for Alex then, but he was just Alex Ferguson. But with my mum and dad, and literally the first thing they said to me, what they offered me, I signed. Didn't even bargain. You know, I could have probably gotten miles more. I signed for absolute peanuts, to be honest with you. Because I was at one, I just wanted to go to United. And two, you know, I was a United fan growing up as well. So I just wanted to sign, get it signed and sealed, you know what I mean? And sign for one of the biggest clubs in the world. So I literally went to United with my mum and dad and signed. No agent or anything.
Well, listen, you took the plunge and you made it, didn't you? You made your debut in the 2-0 win against Bury in the League Cup. Needed extra time for that one, but you got an assist on your debut as well.
Yeah, I was absolutely buzzing with making my debut for United. I didn't actually know anything about it until probably 2 hours before kickoff. So Alex Ferguson pulled me into the office and said, "Listen, I was part of the squad, but I thought I might have been on the bench or something like that." And he pulled me into the office and said, "Listen, you're starting tonight. I've already told your mum and dad. Your mum and dad will be here in the crowd," which my mum and dad didn't tell me about because they didn't want me to be too nervous, which was absolutely brilliant of the club to do that for me. And, I started the game. And, you know, to walk out at Old Trafford, 19 years old, you know, being a United fan and, you know, walking out in front of them fans, you know, on a nighttime game, was just absolutely incredible. And like you say, you know, I thought I played quite well. I think I got man of match in paper the next day. And, you know, I had an absolute, you know, whale of a time playing up front with Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, which, you know, watching him on TV and Sky the previous years as a kid growing up was just an amazing feeling and a night I'll never forget.
I can imagine, mate. And to be fair, it was a pretty decent lineup. I know, as I said, it went to extra time and we probably should have beaten them in normal time, but you know what? They were a half-decent team with Berry. I mean, they had the likes of Andy Woodward there and Chris Lucchetti were pretty decent and Steve Redman as well.
That's right, yeah.
But in terms of United's team lineup, there was a couple of players there that, like Jordi Cruyff, who perhaps didn't have a great time at the club. Phil Mulryan, who I thought was a very decent player in the reserves. And obviously Michael Clegg, who's back at the club now, doing the strength and conditioning. But when you saw that lineup and you thought, wow, Henning Berg, Jordi Cruyff, Solskjaer, I don't think you were in awe of those players because obviously you were training with them throughout the week, no?
I think I signed in the March, April time earlier that year, and I played a few Manchester United A-team games, scored quite a few goals. Then obviously, you know, we had the break before pre-season started. But from pre-season, from 1st of July, you know, I was training with the first team squad every single day nearly. And so, you know, you get used to playing with them kind of players and, you know, by playing with them every day that you're good enough to be part of it. And, you know, you take the likes of Jordi Cruyff, who, you know, had played for Barcelona and teams like that. So, you knew he was, you know, a very good player. Mm. And, you know, like you say, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, you know, amazing finisher and an amazing striker, proven at United for years before I got there. So, you know, it was an absolute pleasure to play with them kind of players. And I think the biggest thing for me, the best thing for me was it was just a dream come true, you know, putting the shirt on in a proper game. You know, obviously I played a few games for the A team, a few resi games, played a few pre-season games, but to actually put that kit on and actually walk out in front of, you know, the fans at Old Trafford on a nighttime game in a proper game was just an amazing feeling and, you know, one I'll never ever forget.
Yeah, prehistoric season, which we'll go into in just a bit. Kojo, you got any questions?
So I was going to ask, because I've always been unsure about this guy, how good was Raymond van der Gaal?
Van der Gaal?
Yeah, how good is he? Because I knew he was a backup, but I've been told that he was a good goalkeeper, but I didn't get to watch him.
Oh, yeah, he was top-notch, to be fair. Obviously, you know, Peter Schmeichel was there at the time. He was one of the best goalkeepers ever to have graced Old Trafford and, you know, Premier League, an absolute outstanding keeper. But Raymond was a top-notch goalkeeper, to be honest. You know, unbelievable backup. Very, very good shot stopper, vocally very good. Great guy, great professional. Probably was a bit unlucky that he had someone like Peter Schmeichel in front of him, to be honest, because, you know, he probably could have been a number one at another Premier League club at that time. But, you know, he loved being at United as well. But I think with Raymond, he actually knew that he was second choice, you know, obviously behind Peter Schmeichel, because obviously Peter Schmeichel was a world-class keeper. But Raymond was a top guy, you know, like, brilliant off the pitch, really good with the young lads as well. He'd always stay after training and do extra, you know, stay in goal after training, and so the young lads could do extra finishing and stuff like that. And you know, he was a top class guy as well.
Excellent. And also scores came on quite late in this game. I think he had that 20 minutes of the original 90 before he went to extra time. At that time, he was quite young. How good was he? Did you see him going further on to be improving as a better player? Like, what was his work ethic like as a young player?
Paul Scholes. He was Paul Scholes is, to me, he's the best player I've ever played with. One of the best players, apart from Giggsy, who I've ever played with and played against. Honestly, he was unreal. I know there's a lot of people, you know, who are better footballers than me, like Zidane and Xavi and people out who said how good he is, but honestly, his first touch, he never gave the ball away. He could spray passes like left to right, right to left. You know, he could score goals. You know, he could score tap-ins. He could score from outside the box. He wasn't the fittest guy. He wasn't the strongest guy. I think he even had asthma, you know what I mean? Yeah. He was 5-6 steps ahead of you upstairs in his brain. You know, he had such a good footballing brain that, you know, even when I left United and played against him, you know, you couldn't get near him. You know, he would just literally pass you off the pitch. You'd think, all right, I'm going to go and press him, and he'd just flick it round the corner and get it the other side. Or if you stay off him, he'd just spray it from, you know, an unbelievable pass. He was just, honestly, he was unbelievable.
Awesome. Thank you.
Yeah, I had that discussion with Luke Chadwick the other day on the show, and I said to him, you know, you're at United at the time when Beckham, Veron and Scholes were there. I says, which one of them had the better range of passing? He goes, Scholes.
honestly, he was unbelievable. Like, I mean, everyone says to me, well, there must have been better players you played against and stuff like that, like Henri and Ronaldo and people like that. And I'm like, yeah, I mean, obviously Ronaldo was unbelievable, but for me, Scholes was just an absolute genius, because you look at him and you think, well, he's only 5'6" or 5'7", you know, he's a little bit, you know, he's not ripped like Cristiano Ronaldo, you know, he's not really that fast, he can't really, you know, he's not, you know, the fittest guy, you know, you think you could run all over him, but, you know, he's just, I say he's probably got a brain like Teddy Sheringham, you know, he's 4 or 5 steps ahead of everybody else before they even get to that situation. He's just, his footballing brain is just unreal.
Yeah, and the thing is, what people don't tend to point out about Paul Scholes is how, as his career progressed, he kind of adapted his game to his surroundings, much like Ryan Giggs, who was able to play left back or centre mid. With Scholes, he started off as a number 10. He was an attacking midfielder, and he was really good at making those late runs into the box with, you know, with headers and all that kind of stuff. But as he got older, he dropped deeper, and he was like a quarterback. His range of passing was just incredible.
Yeah, you're 100% correct, mate. Like you say, he was a striker to start with, then he went to number 10, and then, you know, further in his career, he obviously went to sitting centre midfield, spraying it. He could do everything, really. You know, for England, he probably was played out of position. He was playing on the left a lot, but he still was unbelievable. But like you say, like him and Giggsy, you know, they've done it all, they've won it all. The longevity was absolutely incredible, and they made themselves better players because they could play different positions as well. They were so versatile, and, you know, the amount of trophies them two guys have won alone is just incredible.
Okay, the next game is the Champions League final. I think this game, Jonathan, it kind of sums up United's whole campaign, really. It started off pretty ropey with David Beckham in the whole France 98 incident. He scored that last-minute equaliser against Leicester on the first day of the season. And pretty much with the Champions League final, in the sense that it started off ropey, but as it progressed, United became more and more confident and nabbed it at the end. Before we talk about this game itself, mate, what do you remember about David Beckham's first training session back after the France night? Because not many people seem to talk about that. I remember the effigies at West Ham. I remember the stick he got, the abuse. And fair enough, he may have brought a little bit on himself with the sarong, but I'm not going to go into that. But, you know, he was fantastic during that World Cup campaign, and that one incident kind of changed his career. I mean, obviously, he got a lot of stick for it, but it built up his character, and he turned out to be one of the best players that I've ever seen in a United shirt. What do you remember about him coming back to the club after that incident, like debacle?
Yeah, I remember as if it was yesterday. Obviously, you know, I was watching the England games, you know, as well on TV like any normal fan, and, you know, when he got sent off, the amount of stick he got in the papers and in the media was just unbelievable. I remember, you know, there was pictures of him, you know, of like a dummy, you know, being hanged and stuff like that, wasn't there? And stuff like that all over the papers. And to be fair, it was incredible. And, you know, when we went back pre-season, there was so much commotion about it. But I think a lot of credit's got to go to Alex Ferguson and the coaching staff, because, you know, United were, you know, proper like family in the training ground. You know, whatever happened in the training ground stayed in the training ground. And I think Alex Ferguson, the coaches and all the players sort of like shielded him a bit, and you know, helped him out. I remember Bex being at training pre-season and literally, you know, being his same old self, really. You know, we didn't see him out of sorts, like you said. He probably was getting a lot of stick, you know, off the pitch, but he didn't seem to show it, you know, in training and in games and stuff like that. That's probably why he's so resilient as a character, and that's probably why he was such a good player as well, like you say. You know, he probably, with his family around him and, you know, Alex Ferguson, all the coaches and all the players supported him, he probably felt that he had all the support he needed. And like you say, he was absolutely fantastic that season as well.
Yeah, and I think with that actual incident and the way that everyone clubbed together, it kind of showed that there was a siege mentality at United. We knew United were a very disliked team by the press, by many supporters throughout the country. But I think something like that galvanised the club, it galvanised the team. And every game, we looked like we weren't going to win certain games. Obviously, Liverpool in the FA Cup, the Arsenal game in the semi-final, going down to 10 men and the Bergkamp penalty. these little moments throughout the season. It just shows that the character, the teamwork, as you said, the morale within the club was just absolutely immense, which, you know, leads us on to the Champions League final against Barcelona. Now, people don't seem to talk about the semi-final, second leg, as much as the final, obviously, but, you know, Roy Keane scored that goal and then it kind of kicked us on. Then the two yellow cards, which cost those two their place in the final. So, in the build-up to this final, we know that Beckham and Butt are going to play centre-mid. Blomqvist is going to play on the right with Giggs on the left, or vice versa. When you're in that dressing room before the game, you're seeing no Keane, no Scholes. What are you guys thinking against Bayern Munich, who are obviously going for their own treble?
Yeah, well, like you say, you know, you mentioned that the game against Juventus, and, you know, it's called the Roy Keane game, innit? Because he was absolutely unbelievable that night. I remember I was in the squad that night, and I think it was me and Giggsy in the stands. I think Giggsy was suspended for that game, wasn't he?
Right, yeah.
I'm sure he didn't play in that game against Juventus. You know, Roy Keane was absolutely fantastic that night. Obviously, him and Paul Scholes got books for the Mr. Final, like you said. But I think, you know, being in the change room before the actual final, obviously, I didn't know I was going to be on the bench until I actually turned up to the ground, because, you know, we knew Keane and Scholes, they were going to miss it. I think Henning was injured as well. There was one space left on the bench, and it was probably going to be out of me and John Curtis. You remember John Curtis?
Oh, yeah.
And so me and John were a bit nervous, obviously, because we knew there was one place spare and we didn't know which one was going to get it. And obviously, when we turned up to the new camp, my shirt was hung up, and Ferguson said I was on the bench. So I was absolutely, you know, buzzing my tits off, to be honest. But looking around the change rooms, it was, you know, quite relaxed, quite, you know... confident, you know. Obviously, we'd just won the league 10 days previous and the FA Cup, so there was, you know, where everybody was, you know, high as a kite, really. You know, we were losing confidence, so obviously we're missing two major players, but, you know, we had some incredible players, you know, in the squad as well. So, like you say, you know, Beck's played centre mid, and Giggsy played on the wing, and Nicky Butt was outstanding, and then, you know, obviously Coley and Yorkie up front, you know, would have been absolutely amazing all year. Probably didn't play the best like they normally do, but then, you know, that's why you have a strong bench. And, you know, Teddy and Ollie came on, and, you know, what an incredible last 3 or 4 minutes it was.
Yeah, well, I guess the momentum took us into this game, because we'd beaten Spurs on the final day of the season quite dramatically. There was the FA Cup final win against Newcastle, which, no disrespect to Newcastle, but it seemed like a pretty straightforward victory, that final, to be fair. But going into this one, as I said, you're playing against a Bayern Munich side, going for their own treble, the likes of Mario Basler, Lothar Matthäus, who'd never won a European Cup before. He'd won the World Cup, but never won the European Cup. So you're a goal down. What happens at half-time? What's being said in the dressing room?
I just remember Ferguson saying, you know, we can do it. He was really confident. He was, you know, basically saying, you know, I think he was talking about the age of their team and saying that they were tired, and, you know, we've got more youth in our team, and, you know, the longer the game goes on, you know, we'll be stronger. There was never any negativity. It was all positive messages, you know, saying make sure, you know, we're the ones lifting that trophy at the end of the game. And, you know, it was very short, very sharp. But the players were very, 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 very concentrated. You know, not many people were talking, just Alex and Steve McLaren, and really, really focused, really. And I actually thought at half time, just watching the team talk, that we'd go on and win the game, but I didn't think we'd leave it such a late as we did.
Yeah, mate, tell me about it. I was having kittens that night, to be fair. Janka hit the bar. I think they hit the post. I think it might have been Sally Hamidic that hit the bar. I'm not sure.
To be fair, it wasn't probably the greatest Champions League game ever. The quality, I'm sure, probably wasn't the best. You know, I mentioned, you know, some of the United players who were superb all season probably didn't play the best games, but, you know, probably some of the Bayern Munich players, you know, were quite poor as well. It wasn't the most quality of Champions League final, but the last 5 minutes, you know, just made it such a special occasion.
Oh, absolutely. So, we get a corner. Does Schmeichel ask for permission to go up, or does he just go up anyway?
I think he just goes up anyway. I don't think he would have cared.
So, obviously, you know, Sheringham pulls it level, and I guess you guys are thinking, Oh, extra time is looming. Are you thinking that you might get a chance? Or I can't remember if we made a lot of substitutions, to be fair.
Yeah, I don't think we, I think we were probably thinking it was going to go into extra time. Obviously, Teddy scored. If you remember rightly, all the bench and most of half the staff went running into the corner to celebrate with all the players and Teddy in the corner. Yeah. And then by the time we'd got back to the bench, we were like knackered from sprinting all that way, and then we were so excited. We were probably thinking, "Oh, let's just hope we get." I just remember thinking, "Let's hope we get to extra time." I think Nicky Butt had gone down with a, you know, where he was sort of like limping or something as well, like that. And a few of the lads were looking to each other, thinking, "Oh, Butty looks like he's struggling. One of us might have to go on here." And I was thinking, "Bloody hell! I hope it's not me. If I come on and lose the Champions League for United at 20 years old, I'm going to be screwed forever." And then obviously we got another corner literally straight away, and then, you know, it all just went crazy, didn't it? You know, Ollie putting the ball in the back of the net, and everybody off the bench again straight into the corner celebrating, and it was just absolutely surreal. You know, two moments of absolute madness, really. And, you know, I still remember it as if it was yesterday.
Oh, mate, that's I'm sure every United fan that witnessed it can remember what they were doing or where they were on that night. But before I let Kojo ask this question, because I know he's itching and I'm taking up too much of the time, sorry, Coach. Over 1 million people in Manchester for the parade.
Yeah, crazy. Absolutely crazy. I remember getting back the following day, the following afternoon, and, you know, getting off the plane onto the bus, and loads of fans, and obviously getting the bus through from Manchester and to I can't remember where it was at. What was it, the Manchester Evening News?
Yes, MEN Arena, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and just full of people celebrating, you know, being on top of the bus. Yorkie with a cigar, you know, the trophies. Yorkie was still steaming. I think everyone was still steaming. And just obviously celebrating with the fans. And it was just amazing because, you know, I was, you know, 20 years old, and I'd only literally just signed that March, the March the year before. And being a United fan and being around all these superstars and, you know, world-class international players was just a dream come true. And to see all the fans in the street was just, you know, something. You know, to be fair, just thinking about it, my hair's standing up on the back of my neck.
Brilliant. Kojo?
So what was preparation like for the final? I mean, you found out late about getting into the squad for the bench, but like, how do you prepare for a final? What side folks and looking for? What was he doing with the players? You know, how was the preparation on the way to the new camp?
Yeah. Well, it was quite relaxed, to be fair, pal. You know, obviously, we'd won the league against Tottenham, you know, 10 days previous. And it was a bit of a strange one, because obviously it was the first time I'd ever been part of winning the league. And I just remember afterwards thinking, we've got the FA Cup final in a week. What's going to happen tonight? Anyway, you know, we went out, we had a party to celebrate winning the league. Everyone was steaming, you know, getting in at whatever time they got in. And then the following week, going into the FA Cup final, it was quite relaxed, really, you know, there wasn't much intensity in the training. It was nice and relaxed going into the FA Cup final. And obviously, we won the FA Cup final against Newcastle, like you mentioned. And it was quite an easy game, I thought, you know, where Newcastle were quite poor in the day. And United didn't really have to be at 100% to beat them. And then after the game, you know, being part of the squad, I think me and Wes Brown had got left out that day. And, you know, we'd won the FA Cup, celebrating. Going back to the hotel, I'm thinking, well, we can't really celebrate like we did, you know, the week before, like winning the league, because we've got the Champions League game on Wednesday, you know, 4 days away. And basically, we were just absolutely steaming as well. You know what I mean? Got back into the night, and I'm thinking, I'm at one of the world's biggest clubs in the world. We've got a Champions League game on Wednesday, where everyone's absolutely smashed. It was mental. And then on the Sunday, I think we got the Concorde to Barcelona. On the Sunday, and just remember the training. We trained Monday, Tuesday morning, but it was really relaxed, just a few rondo boxes and a bit of this. And Alex Ferguson was so relaxed and calm. He would let us sunbathe, he'd let us, you know, rest by the pool. Didn't really do much other than that. Had a few team meetings, but basically, you know, just a couple of light sessions and a bit of relaxation, a bit of snooker. And just chilling out before the big day. I remember the day of the game on the Wednesday morning, just, you know, chilling out, having breakfast and pre-match meal, and you know, Alex Ferguson having a meeting and just talking about Bayern Munich and stuff like that. And basically it was just like playing any other normal game. I think, you know, he just wanted to keep it, you know, nice and relaxed for the players, and it 100% worked.
Lovely. And well, you're a big part of history, the treble. I was 8 at the time, and I just remember screaming like a little girl for like 2 weeks, going to school, bragging about it. How does it feel to be part of that history? I mean, because that's permanent. No one can ever take that away from you guys.
It means the world. I mean, you know, a lot of people say, you know, you didn't deserve to have a Champions League medal and stuff like that. But and for a long time, I used to sort of like think very similar. But, you know, looking back, when you retire, you look back at these times and you think, you know, I did deserve it because, you know, I trained every day with the first team. You know, I travelled to nearly every single game, home and away, that year. You know, obviously, most games I was the 19th man, the one left out, you know. But I was always, you know, even after Champions League games after a Premier League game on a Saturday, I'd go with the first team. And if I wasn't involved, I'd go in on a Sunday and train with the reserves. And then I'd play a reserve game maybe Monday night. Then I'd travel on the Tuesday to a Champions League game, you know, train with the first team, and then be the 19th man and get left out again, you know. And, wow. And this, but I did that for the whole year, do you know what I mean? So, yeah. You know, I know obviously Keno and Scholes, he got suspended and there was a few injuries, but I was part of the, you know, lifting the trophy on against the Tottenham. I was part of the FA Cup final squad, and I was part of the, you know, the Champions League final squad, you know, being on the bench. So looking back, you know, I'm obviously, you know, really proud because, you know, as a young kid, I was a Man United fan as well. So it's sort of like double bubble for me because, you know, I'm a United fan, so I get all that kind of thing as well, you know, from the fans' point of view. But I actually, you know, signed for the club I supported, and, you know, I was part of, like you say, the treble, which will never be taken away from me. You know, I'm probably one of the most famous pub questions out there. Who's got a Champions League medal, who's not played any minute of European football?
Well, listen, you got it. No one else has, so don't worry about it.
Yeah, that's true.
There you go. Right. Our next game, mate. Blimey, now this one. Oof. Final day of the season. The Great Escape. Now, this is going back to 2004. West Brom, bottom of the Premier League with just 10 points. I think it was 1 win and 7 draws after 19 matches. Gary Megson gets the boot. Brian Robson, another Manchester United legend, takes over. Bearing in mind that no team had survived relegation after being bottom of the league in December. He brings in Kieran Richardson on loan. I'm not saying Kieran was the reason you guys stayed up.
No, he was a big reason.
Yeah, but you know, you had Kevin Campbell, brought him on loan, on a free, I think, from Everton. Richard Chaplow came in as a pretty decent player there. And I think the pivotal game, mate, was against Birmingham City, wasn't it? I believe, anyway.
Yeah.
Neil Clement scored, and then Kevin Campbell scored twice, I think.
Yeah, that's right.
He scored once or twice, I can't remember, he scored once or twice. But then, final day of the season, you need a win and hope that results go your way. And yeah, I'll leave this one over to you, mate.
Yeah, well, it's definitely up there in, you know, my top five, because like you say, we were bottom at Christmas. Everyone had said we were going to get relegated. Brian Robson had come in, he was obviously one of my heroes, so it was amazing to have him as manager. And like you say, you know, we had the first part of the season, we were poor, we were low on confidence, and there's nothing worse than losing game after game. And everybody in the media and TV was saying we're going to get relegated. So to actually get it to the last game of the season at home against Portsmouth, we knew we needed to win. We needed other results to go for us on the day. And it was just absolutely crazy. I don't know if you remember it on Sky. It was like survival. It was like a Survival Sunday special or something like that. And there was like 4 or 5 games going on at the same time. Obviously, we were one of them. And, you know, we were playing against Portsmouth, and Southampton were in trouble as well. They could have got relegated that day as well. And so we knew we needed to beat Portsmouth. And going into the game, we were really confident and that we'd get the 3 points and hopefully the results would go for us. But I just remember I actually came off injured, I think, on the 70-something minute. And Jeff Horsfield came on and scored. So I'm taking it, me coming off as one of the game. But we won the game. We won 2-0, I think. And after the game, there was a bit of a blip because some of the other games were still going on, so we didn't actually know if we'd survived or not. So there was a bit of a a thing on the side of the pitch because we didn't know if we'd been relegated or if we'd stayed up. And then all of a sudden, about 2 minutes into it, it was announced that we'd stayed up, and all the fans—I don't know if you remember—the whole of the stadium just ran onto the pitch and started celebrating, taking all clothes off the players. And all the Portsmouth fans were celebrating as well because they'd heard Southampton had got relegated. Yep. So literally, the whole stadium, 28,000 people, were just going crazy because obviously we'd stayed up and Southampton had got relegated. So it was just a mad day.
Yeah. It's funny how things work out because I remember you came to Old Trafford and I was at that one when you drew 1-1 when Robert Earnshaw scored from the spot.
Yeah, Jeff Borfield got pulled down, didn't he, by, was it Shazy?
Oh, Shay, yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah, I remember it. Yeah, I played that game.
And the funny thing was about this one, I was with my mate in Stretfordham for that one, and we weren't upset that you guys got something out of this one because we wanted, obviously, West Brom to stay out because of you, because of Richardson, because of, obviously, Brian Robson as well.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
And I think as United fans, it was pretty pleasing to beat Southampton on the final day, and the one thing I remember most about that day is United fans were doing a countdown in injury time. I shouldn't laugh because there's Southampton fans probably listening, but United fans were doing a countdown, which is ridiculous. But as for this game, you blitzed Portsmouth, didn't you?
Yeah. To be fair, I think when I went off, we won 1-0 up, and then Orth came on and scored the decisive goal. But I think we absolutely battered him first half. You know, we're all over him. To be fair, Portsmouth actually think Portsmouth wanted Southampton to go down, even the players and the team, because they didn't seem like they were trying a leg. I know we were proper up for the game because obviously, you know, we wanted to stay up. You know, all the players were going to lose 40% of the wages if they got relegated. You know, people, you know, the training ground would lose the jobs and stuff like that. And obviously, we tried to do it for the fans as well. So we were well up for the game, but it honestly didn't look like Portsmouth were that up for it, to be honest.
Fair enough. Well, look, what is Brian Robson like as a manager? Because we saw him at Middlesbrough, how he did pretty well, got them to 2 FA Cup finals, but unfortunately they got relegated. But he kind of revived them when he took over at the beginning when they were at Ayresome Park. So was there a feeling of, like a new manager bounce at the club and you kind of felt that he was the guy that was going to galvanise you a lot and push you over the line?
Yeah, definitely. I absolutely loved Robbo as my manager. He was absolutely fantastic. He had Nigel Pearson alongside him as his assistant manager as well. He was one of my heroes growing up as well. He was brilliant as a manager. He was a very good manager. His training sessions were enjoyable, hard work, but really enjoyable. You know, it wasn't, you know, easy going training. It was hard, like what you would do at United, so I was obviously very used to that, and he got us a real good team spirit going, a bit like United really. You know, we got everyone together, like you mentioned. He brought a bit of youth in with Kieran Richardson, he brought Kevin Campbell in for a bit of experience, and he got all the lads together. We had a little mini break to Orlando in the February, and a bit of hot weather training, which was absolutely fantastic for the group. And after that week of training out there and doing bits and bobs, you know, going for meals and stuff like that, and going to water parks, and you know, get a bit of bonding going, we came back and, you know, we were like a new team. You know, where everyone fighting for each other, and I think that's one of the main reasons we stayed up that year, due to Brian Robson, really.
Brilliant. And just one more question from me. We mentioned Kieran Richardson earlier. Now, I heard the story a while back from when he was at United. He bought a new car, a flashy new car, came in, and Roy Keane absolutely battered him. And he, next day, he came back with the old banger.
I've heard this story, yeah.
You know this one, yeah? And a lot of United fans labelled him Lord Snooty, which wasn't really fair, to be fair, because, you know, I didn't have any problems with Kieran Richardson. I think he was a good servant to the club. Did very well left back when he was given the opportunity to as well. So, yeah. I think he was a bit unlucky at United. But in terms of his presence at West Brom, he scored a very vital goal in that game, and he was pretty decent at set pieces as well.
Yeah, he was brilliant for us. Like you say, he came on loan to end the season, and you know, he brought a lot of energy, a lot of youth. And I always remember the first time he actually turned up. We were having an away game, and he came on the bus, and he had a he had a leather suit on, and he went to the back of the bus where some of the most experienced players, you play cards, Jeff Horsfield, Andy Johnson, and people like that, and he was laid on back at sea, and Horse just went, "Oh, you get off," and literally came and was like, "All right," but he had this like dapper leather suit on. He was a bit of a wide boy, was Kieran, but he was top man. You know, he liked his fashion, he liked his. Spending his money on his designer stuff, but he was a top lad, you know, good fun, you know, a bit out there, but he was a real good lad, and like you say, without him, we probably wouldn't have stayed up.
I remember back in 07, we played Watford in the FA Cup semi-final at Villa Park, and we was at that one, me and a mate of mine, and Richardson has come on. And within a few minutes, he scored the third or the fourth, I can't remember. And there's two guys in front of me. The moment the ball went in the back of net, one of them gave the other one a £20 note. We just started laughing. We're like, they've obviously made a bet. Like, he's going to score. Nah, he's not going to score, whatever.
Class.
Yeah. No, United fans, they've got a very good sense of humour.
Yeah, they have, yeah.
Kojo, any questions, mate?
You played with Zoltan Girov, another player that I don't know why. So when I was younger, I had a lot of players that I loved for. I mean, I'll tell you, like, oh, I love Zoltan Girov. Why? I don't know why. I just really like him. It didn't really make sense. But yeah, he was a tidy player. So and I thought it was quite key to your staying up as well. What did he bring to the team?
You're spot on, mate. He was a top man, to be fair. He signed the same time as me for West Brom, and like you say, he was a very, very good player. He could score any kind of goal, you know, tap-ins, headers, long range. His energy levels were unbelievable. You know, he could get up and down all day. He put a shift in for the team. Obviously, I played with him for West Brom for a few years, and then played with him at Fulham for a couple of years as well. And he was brilliant for us at Fulham as well. He was probably a massive part of why we got to the Europa League final in 2009-10. You know, he was absolutely incredible that year. I think he got Fulham's player of the season. But he's just a top man as well. I actually spoke to him on Saturday night via a Zoom call, and he's doing Hungary under-21s at the moment. So he's just got into coaching, and he hasn't changed. He's exactly the same. He's a really, really funny guy, because he speaks with broken English, and when he first came over to England, to West Brom, a lot of the lads were teaching him like really bad languages, you know, as those English lads do. You know, he didn't hardly speak English, so everyone was teaching him all the bad words, you know what I mean? So after the time he speaks English, it's in swear words.
Oh, mate, do you know what, I can relate to that, because I can obviously speak Greek as well. So when we had new kids at the school, they'd start learning a bit of English, and then we'd start teaching them a few of the Greek swear words, and then the Turkish kids would teach them the Turkish swear words. That's all you teach them. There's all the swear words. I need to ask Matt if he knows any Greek swear words. I'm sure he does. So
yeah, he will do. I'm sure he does. But yeah, getting back to Zolly, we used to call him Zolly, and he was a really, really good lad, and you know, obviously, like you say, a really, really good player as well, just to go along with it as well.
And for comedic value, was it that season when Kanu missed from, I don't know, was it a yard or?
You just got your Ghanaian hat on, haven't you?
No, this is no bias.
Sorry, Jonathan, he's doing this whole Ghana-Nigeria rivalry thing, right?
No, it was, yeah, you're totally right. I can't remember who was against. It was literally 2 yards out, and all he had to do is tap it in, and it's gone off his heel and gone over the crossbar from about 2 yards out.
Against Middlesbrough.
Middlesbrough, that's right. Yeah, yeah. I remember the game, and I remember all the lads in the change room afterwards going, "How the fuck has he missed that?" Honestly, it's unbelievable how he missed it, innit?
It's crazy. I still laugh about it to this day. I'm just like.
But Cardiff was one of them players. Cardiff was one of those players who's, you know, so chilled out, so relaxed. You know, he was an unbelievable player. But, you know, off the pitch, he's so, you know, he's so horizontally, you know, he's so chilled out and spaced out that nothing bothers him. So him missing that chance, you know, in the change room after the game, he wouldn't have been asked at all, do you know what I mean? Whereas all the lads were like, how the hell has he missed that?
Quality player, though.
Yeah, top player.
Wonderful footballer. Yeah, absolutely.
Did he ever talk about the gold medal he won at the Atlanta Olympics?
No. He was quite reserved, was Carl. He was a really funny guy. He's the most fine person I've ever played with. You know, he was constantly late for training and he was getting fined left, right and centre. And he'd just laugh it off and just pay it. And the worst thing was, he had a chauffeur who used to drive his Ferrari, right, with him sleeping in it, to training, and he was still late nearly every day. And we used to say to him, Carnu, you've got a £180,000 Ferrari, and you've got a chauffeur who drives you. How the hell are you late every day?
Oh, mate, I've got a funny Carnu story, but I don't know, I can tell it. It's not bad. Years ago, we're talking probably 2001, anyway. We used to go to this nightclub called Eros in North London, and the ritual was we would finish there and we'd go to a kebab shop in Southgate about 3-4 in the morning. And lo and behold, we're outside this kebab shop eating. Who turns up in a Mercedes? It's Carnu. He's gone in with, I don't know whether it was his wife or his girlfriend at the time, where it was, right? And he's ordered his food at, as I said, 3-4 o'clock in the morning. And as he's walking out, this guy, pissed off his nut, sees him and goes, "Oh my God, you're Carnu. I've got an Arsenal shirt with your name on the back." And he just looks at me and goes, "Thank you." And I just walked off. And the guy's heckling him. And we're like, "Mate, he's, you know, he's not going to sleep with you." Like,
to be fair, that is Carnu to a T. He just would probably just say thank you.
Just walked off. But yeah. It was one of those moments where you felt embarrassed for the guy because he's obviously seen Carnu, which is his hero. I don't think he had the Carnu shirt, but Carnu was just so cool about it. He was just like, "Yeah, thank you."
He was top player, Carnu. I played in his, he's got a charity, you know, for his Heart Foundation.
That's right.
I played in his charity game a couple of years ago. Obviously, he's doing a lot of things for that foundation, and he was absolutely brilliant that day. He put a really good game, and you know, I'm really happy he's doing well.
Absolutely, mate. Absolutely. Right, final game. Blimey, we've taken over an hour of your time, Jonathan. Thanks for that, mate.
No, no worries.
Cheers. Final game. 2-0 victory at QPR. You guys secured the championship title. Very good win. Tell us about this one, because I think Tony Mowbray was in charge then, no?
Yeah, Tony was in charge. You know, the year before, the 2006-07 season, we'd got to the playoff final, losing to Derby 1-0, and, you know, we played some really good stuff that year. And after the game, obviously, everybody was upset that we'd lost and not gone back to the Premier League. Everybody was saying, all the media and TV were saying, we won't get promoted playing the way we were playing because we were really open, attacking football. And literally, we just blitzed the league, really, the following year, 2007-08. You know, we went down to the last game, and it was out of us and Stoke who were going to be champions. And, you know, we had to win QPR at Loftus Road to win the championship. As long as we won our game, it didn't matter what Stoke did, regarding their result. And we literally went down to Loftus Road and absolutely passed them off the park, won 2-0. And it was one of the best days ever because I'd started, you know, every single game that season. We'd got to the semi-final of the FA Cup against Portsmouth, which we lost 1-0, which I'd started every game and that as well. So I think I played about 52, 53 games that year. Wow. So to play all them games and, you know, especially in the league, and to win the championship in the last game of the season with such a convincing performance and being captain as well, which made it 100 times better, and to lift that trophy with all the players who I loved at the time and all the staff and fans was just an incredible thing for me personally and collectively with my team.
Absolutely, man. I think that was West Brom's first trophy in over 40 years.
I think I was the first captain to win a trophy for quite a few years, and obviously they've not won a trophy since, but I think the biggest thing about that season was we played some incredible football. We scored so many goals. We had obviously Kevin Phillips, who was on fire, as well. And we had such a good team spirit, such great lads, and, you know, real good team spirit. And, you know, having the knockback in the playoff final the previous year, a lot of teams would have crumbled, but, you know, we bounced right back straight away and, you know, won the championship and got the club back to the Premier League and earned the chairman his 80 million what he wanted. And I always remember after the game going back to the hotel to celebrate with, you know, family and friends and the missus and all the players. And the chairman was that pleased with us. He put £500 behind the bar for us winning the championship.
Superb. There you go. That's what you need. That's what you need.
I was like, cheers, chairman. We just won you 80 million. And you only put 500 quid behind that.
It's at least you could do. Just a quick one. If you look at Leeds' situation at the moment, obviously the season has been paused or been put on hold due to, obviously, COVID-19. You guys went through a grueling campaign to get promoted. Forget, you know, the financial side of things. How deflated do you think these Leeds players must be feeling right now, not knowing what the future entails?
Oh, absolutely. If I was a player now, I'd be absolutely gutted, honestly, because, you know, they've absolutely, you know, played some incredible stuff this year, and the Leeds, and, you know, they were so close last year. They've been out of the Premier League for, what is it, 20 years now or something like that, or something ridiculous, 18 years, whatever. And they're so close, and like you say, what is there, nine games left or something like that? Games left. The way they were playing, how strong they were, and, you know, the way they were blitzing teams, they probably would have, them and West Brom would have gone on to probably get first and second place. So if I was a Leeds player now, I'd be absolutely gutted, you know, because, you know, you played, whatever, 37, 38 games, you've only got 8 or 9 games left, whatever it is. You would just want to finish them off. You want to finish them off, get your results on board, get your performances in, and get that trophy and get that medal around your neck so you can look back in 10, 20 years' time and say, we did it properly, you know what I mean? You know, the season wasn't null and void. We didn't work given the league. We actually won it. We're playing the full fixtures, you know, 46 games.
Yeah. Well, that leads me on to my next question, actually, because you mentioned the 46 games. Obviously, that's the fundamental difference between the Premier League and the Championship, but you having played for Man United, probably the greatest Man United of our generation, going down to the Championship, what were the main differences in terms of the style of play down there, in terms of the intensity and everything else in general?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's completely different. The Championship, I actually love watching the Championship. I don't know what you guys think.
But it's probably the most entertaining league in Europe.
I love watching the Championship because anybody can beat anybody on the day. It's so intense, you know. It's, you know, back and forth. I mean, the thing I always say when people ask me this question, I always say, for me as a player, it was easier playing in the Premier League because you got more time in the ball. You know, it was technically, the ball was on the floor a lot more. You know, the players were technically better. You know, people were more possession based than they are in the Championship. Obviously, there's a few possession based teams in the Championship now, but probably back when I was playing, there probably wasn't as much. I think so. For me, it was easier playing in the Premier League because, you know, you're playing with better players, you had more time in the ball, you're playing on better pitches and stuff like that. I know the pitches are much better now in the Championship, but playing in the Championship for me was, you know, sometimes you play against a couple of teams who try to play like, you know, Premier League teams, but most of the time it was probably a little bit more long ball, you know, more balls into the box, a little bit more rush, more tackles, more end-to-end, probably a little bit dirtier. You're probably not as protected as much in the Championship. And it was probably a bit more rush, you know what I mean, compared to the Premier League.
Fair enough. Kojo?
I thought I was going to ask now. I was enjoying that.
Boom.
Tony Mowbray, that's what I was going to ask about. Quite underrated manager. How's the season under him as a player under his management?
Yeah, well, obviously, you know, I love Tony to bits. You know, he gave me the captain's armband at West Brom and put a lot of responsibility on my shoulder, which, you know, I've got a lot to thank him for because he believed in me. But I think with Tony as a manager, you know, you know, his training sessions were very good. He's very, you know, intelligent footballing-wise. You know, he's got a real good footballing brain. He's got a way of playing. He's got a philosophy. He likes to play football from the back, you know, quite entertaining football, possession-based, but with a purpose, you know, trying to get the ball in certain areas to create chances. He loves scoring goals. He loves his team to be forward-thinking and score plenty of goals. And probably that's why we were probably a little bit shaky at the back, because, you know, we were so forward-thinking and trying to get, you know, people in attacking areas to score goals. But I think, you know, like I mentioned earlier, you know, after the play, when we lost in the playoff final to Derby, you know, a lot of people said to Tony, you need to change the way you're playing and be probably a bit more defensive. But he wasn't having that. He carried on playing the same way. So, you know, I've got a lot of admiration for him because he's brave in the way he wants to play, and obviously it worked because we got back promoted, but then probably the year after we probably should have been a bit more defensive because we got relegated from the Premier League again, you know what I mean? But he won't change the way he wants to play. He wants to play football on the floor, you know, open kind of game of football, and for me he's a top manager. And you know, obviously he's doing okay at Blackburn at the moment. He didn't have the best spell at Celtic and Middlesbrough, but for me he's a top manager.
Yeah,
right.
Awesome.
Great stuff.
That's me.
Nice one, brilliant. Well, Jonathan, I'm not going to take up too much of your time, mate. Again, really appreciate you jumping on, and yeah, I'm sure our listeners appreciate it too. Before I let you go, mate, again, I'm going to put you on the spot now because I haven't asked you this before. But if you were to name an 11 players who you've played with and against, who would you say are the best? Your best 11 played with and against?
Oh, mate, it's. I did this the other day. I've actually got it on my WhatsApp, and it took me about 5 days to do. Do you want me to get it up for you? Well, let me try and get it up.
All right, okay.
Right, try and get it up, mate.
I promise I haven't hacked your WhatsApp and looked at your messages.
So basically, you know, I played with so many players. You know, I could put Coley, Yorkie, Teddy, Ollie, and all them kind of players in, but I didn't play probably too many games with them. Do you know what I mean? No. As in consistently. So this 11. I picked is a bit of both players I played with a little bit and players I played along with, do you know what I mean?
That's cool, yeah.
So I went for Schmeichel in goal, mm-hmm. Because obviously, you know,
he's best keeper ever, hands down. Yeah,
yeah, he's just tremendous, isn't he? Yeah. I went with Gary Neville right back, mm-hmm. Yap Stam centre half, and then I've gone with Gareth Southgate, who was my captain at Middlesbrough for 3 years, who was brilliant with me as a young player, you know, playing week in, week out. He was absolutely fantastic with me. Obviously played for England as well, England manager now. But he was a big help for me as a young kid, you know, playing week in, week out when I went from Manchester United to Middlesbrough. So I put him in. Mm-hmm. Dennis Irwin, left back.
Yep.
Betts, right mid, obviously. Mm-hmm. Keno, centre mid with Scholesy.
Yep.
Ryan Giggs, left wing. And then I've gone Janino in the hole with Kevin Phillips up front.
me and Kojo almost fell off our chairs. You mentioned Junior Paulista.
Janino was incredible, man. Little Brazilian magic, could take players on, could do tricks, could do flicks, could score goals, could assist. Kevin Phillips is one of the best, you know, natural finishers I've ever seen. I played with him for 2 years at West Brom. He scored, I think, about 40 odd goals in 2 years. But then, obviously, I've got on my sub bench, I've got Coley, Yorkie, Teddy, Alan Bocic, Mendy, Steven Gerrard, and Frank Lampard, who I played with England 21s.
Jeez.
Wow. But there's so many players who are missing off there as well, do you know what I mean? So, it's so hard, mate. It took me about 4 or 5 days to forget this.
Jeez. And what about players you've played against, though? Now, that's one.
Yeah, I haven't thought about that. So I need to, off my top of my head, obviously, I'd probably go Xavi, Henri, Shearer, Rooney, you know, all the ones you probably think, you know, who probably played in the Premier League, similar to me, Zola, Frank Lampard, you know, Scholesy, all the one United players who I played against as well. Who else is there? I'll tell you who was a good player who probably people might forget. Do you remember Deco?
Of course.
Yeah. I played against him for West Brom against Chelsea live on Sky, mate, and he absolutely tore me a new arsehole. I think he megged me 3 times in the first half.
Blimey, mate, that's some list. We need to talk about this again another time, man, honestly.
No problems. I'll have a little think about it. Next time I come on, I'll do you 11 I played against.
You have a deal. Well, look, Jonathan, man, listen, I really appreciate it, man. And, it's been an absolute honour talking to you. I got nothing else to say. So before we let you go, do you want to plug anything? Have you got, I know you use Twitter and all that. Is there anything you want to mention?
No, just hopefully, you know, you guys stay safe and well, and hopefully we can get back to things being normal, and we can probably do a session face-to-face next time, eh?
Oh, absolutely, you're on, 100%. Appreciate it. Cheers, mate.
Perfect.
Great stuff. Kojo?
Yes?
Anything to plug, my friend?
I haven't done podcasting in a long time, but
shame on you.
just plug my podcast, Free in Midfield. And of course, also Footy Says are doing a lot recently. We've got Brita Sombalonga coming on soon to do an interview, so we're preparing ourselves for that. So, yeah, that's about it from me. And hopefully I can chat with you guys very, very soon.
Absolutely, mate. Well, that's our interview with Jonathan Greening. In top five matches in the bank. We're on Twitter at Shoot the Defence. We also have an Instagram page, and I'm posting a lot of mid-90s football nostalgia. I've got loads of Shoot and Match magazines. I'm going to try and find with Jonathan in there. I'm sure I've got one there somewhere. So that's it for us this week, guys. So until next time, take care.